Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the contributors to strategypage.com discuss news as history and give you a unique view of events around the world. I'm Dan Masterson, publisher of strategypage.com, your host. We'll be talking to Jim Dunnigan, well-known military analyst, author, and editor of strategypage.com, and Al Nofi, military historian and author. Al compiles and writes our popular CIC section on the site. Welcome, Al and Jim. It's December again, and I know every time in December when it starts getting cold and I see the snow out on the ground and like that, I start thinking about the Battle of the Bulge, because my grandfather was in the Battle of the Bulge and my father-in-law was with Patton's army when they came up. They were both rear echelon people. My father-in-law was a clerk. My grandfather was a mechanic, and my grandfather specifically got thrown into the battle, and I believe he won a Bronze Star during it. And so it's just something I start thinking about when it gets cold, because my grandfather tells the story about how he had on two sets of long johns, and he'd put on both pair of his fatigue pants, and he was in his sleeping bag, and he was still freezing because it was so cold. One of the things that we want to talk about today is sort of the dirty little secrets of the Battle of the Bulge, things that people don't know about. Al, what's your biggest dirty little secret of the Battle of the Bulge?
Well, it's kind of interesting that World War II has so completely overshadowed the First World War that Battle of the Bulge is actually not the biggest battle in American history. That was New Sargon, in 1918, which lasted much longer and involved more troops, about 1.25 million as opposed to 1 million. And, the Battle of the Bulge, officially, there's about 19,000 American dead. And in the New Sargon, there's nearly 27,000. So a tremendously, overlooked point about the battle. Now, I suppose the reason is, first of all, because we're fighting Hitler and not the Kaiser, and it's fresher in our memories. And I think, secondly, it's the drama of Bastogne and the 101st Airborne putting up this incredible resistance all by itself. We won't discuss the tens of thousands of troops from several other divisions, including a couple of battalions of black artillerymen, who were also in the pocket with them, shooting at the Germans. It has a certain romantic image,
right,
in contrast to the grittiness of the First World War, and going over the top and getting machine gunned as you try and get your way through the trenches. And of course, General McAuliffe's famous nuts puts a sort of a cherry on the top of this romantic image.
Right. Now, was it actually nuts, he said? I've heard myths that he actually used another four-letter word.
No, he apparently said nuts.
Okay.
It's amazing. People didn't quite, they cursed sometimes, but he actually said nuts. Several people who were there said, yeah, he said nuts. Now, of course, don't ask any super sergeant in the army, World War II veteran, that, because he knows personally that McAuliffe said something other than nuts, that Patton had a white Sherman, Sherman painted white, so he could lead the troops into battle, and various other stories that have gotten certainly into the popular culture to a great extent, but also sometimes into the literature.
Right. Jim, what's your biggest dirty secret of the Battle of the Bulge?
That the battle was a huge German mistake. They could have done a lot more damage to us if they kept those troops in a defensive position, because we were still trying to get across the Rhine. And the Germans were very good at using armored forces, even when we had air superiority, or the Russians had air superiority, come up and basically stop offensive operations. By going on the offensive themselves, they basically allowed us to much more easily destroy those forces. both at Bastogne and, more importantly, at St. Vith, which, as Al points out, they don't get any credit up there. But that was a much more critical blocking point than Bastogne was. And then, of course, Patton, who does get credit, turned his army around. Again, something that doesn't get as much credit as it should. You know, it's not easy turning an army 90 degrees, you know, in a few days and marching off in a different direction. But Patton was the kind of guy who took care of details like that and was able to pull it off. But the Germans basically lost their only ability to, you know, make the war last a few more months and, well, possibly make themselves the target for the atomic bomb, because the nuclear bomb was basically designed from the beginning with a Berlin delivery address.
Right.
That only changed after Germany surrendered. But if the Germans had not fought the Battle of the Bulge, you can see where I'm leading here, the war might have lasted long enough for us to have nuked Berlin, which would have had all sorts of implications, you know, to World War II and subsequent history. So you might say that the Battle of the Bulge saved Berlin.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, now, one of the interesting...
Let me interrupt for a minute, because the business about St. Vith is really interesting. While the Germans are trying to bull their way straight ahead, St. Vith, and there was another action along a ridgeline, there was a particular ridgeline which was literally being held by cooks and bakers and radio men in platoon, you know, detachments for several miles, and all the Germans had to do was, you know, make a right and try and hit these guys. And they, you know, they very likely would have made things worse. They still wouldn't have won.
Right.
But they would have certainly made things worse.
Yes.
Yeah, they could have driven deeper into the rear. I mean, it's unlikely they would have ever gotten to Antwerp, which was their major objective, you know, in cutting off, you know, the supplies going to, you know, half a million American and British troops. Because they never even came into contact with the British troops, who were brought up on the other side of the Meuse, the river that they never reached, never quite reached.
I thought according to Montgomery, they won the battle.
Well, again, Montgomery, like MacArthur, had a great publicist, you know.
Yes.
It's just like the paratroopers, you know. Never underestimate a guy with a good publicist. Don't go to war with him either.
Well, in fact, after the battle was over and Montgomery took some credit for it, the U.S. commanders actually wanted him removed, right?
Yes. Well, they wanted him removed for a lot of reasons.
What were some of those other reasons, Jim?
Pardon?
What were some of those other reasons that they wanted him removed?
They didn't consider him reliable enough. You know, he would either be completely, you know, shut down in terms of his planning, you know, would take no chances, or he would take outrageous chances. And basically, he didn't get along well.
Right.
Yeah.
He didn't play well with others, as they say in grammar school.
His great strength was the set-piece battle. I mean, we probably would have had a lot more trouble on D-Day if it wasn't for him totally revising the plan, because he was, you know, obsessed with having superiority. You know. On the other hand, once things started turning into a moving war, for all that he talked about, you know, maneuvers and pencil thrusts and this and that and the other, he wasn't very good at it.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Indeed, he made his bones down in North Africa, Battle of El Alamein, with a magnificent set-piece battle. But once he broke loose, he basically didn't know what to do with the victory he had won.
Right.
And the Germans literally got away.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, one of the most famous massacres of the war happens at this time. What was the situation there?
Yeah.
Germans couldn't have... Actually, that was... Not to justify it or to cut the Germans any slack, but it's understood in war that if you cannot afford to take prisoners with you, you either parole them or kill them. Now, there wasn't much paroling being done in World War II. That was an old Civil War thing most people are familiar with. You know, you were captured and you promised not to take up arms again, they'd let you go. Well, that disappeared by the 20th century, by and large. So the Germans, just as Americans did it too, says, look, we got to advance. We're in enemy territory. We can't afford to take prisoners. What are we going to do? So they just shot them. The fact that the guys doing the shooting were SS, particularly upset American, and well, Canadian especially, and all the Allied troops, because the SS had a particularly brutal reputation. I mean, they would kill prisoners even when they could afford to take them. And they got into a lot of trouble with the Canadians over that in Normandy. And the Canadians, a lot of old elderly Canadian gentlemen are still upset at the Germans in general, and the SS in particular, about, you know, some of the atrocities committed as far down as Normandy. So when Malmedy came along and it came to be known that the SS were involved, well, hey, no professional courtesy for that. These guys are butchers and they got to go. So it just goes to show you that even in wartime, your past will catch up with you very quickly.
Yeah, one of the things I found out about this massacre, that this is where, after the war, when the trial happened, that Joe McCarthy made his bones by coming to the defense of the Germans that were put on trial and saying that they had been tried unfairly. Which is,
well, yeah, I mean, technically they did have a military defense. I mean, it's not something soldiers talk about. There's a lot of things soldiers don't talk about. We, Al and I, put it in our Dirty Little Secrets book, and actually all the books we did on World War II, we stuck a lot of those things in there, because you can go to any VFW, well, for a while anyway, and buy the old-timers a couple of drinks, and you'll get some of these stories. You know, the things they would never tell a journalist, they don't really want to attach their name to it. I mean, for example, friendly fire incidents. There were a lot more of them than were ever reported.
Right.
You're not going to file, you're not going to write home to folks, hey, I just remember Joe McCarthy down the street. Yeah, I waxed him by accident yesterday. No. You're never going to hear about that. And a lot of these guys, you know, it wasn't until years later, decades later, that they would even talk about it, you know, among themselves, usually only after a few stiff drinks. The idea of reporting a guy as missing when you knew he was out there dead because you knew his wife would continue to get his pay for an extra few months.
Right.
The atrocities, shooting prisoners. Mm-hmm. You had to do it. You know, hey, we couldn't afford to take prisoners. We were on a patrol, et cetera, et cetera. Geez, he was a young kid. I hated to do it, but what was I going to do? I'm
right.
Certainly not going to talk about it either.
Yeah, because I had to get back across the lines, and if we'd let the guy go, we would have been all killed before we got back.
Exactly.
Well, they explore that in Private Ryan, remember?
Right.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that's one thing that shocked people with Private Ryan, because it wasn't just the opening scene where you had people getting shot so realistically, but some of the less, you know, pleasant things that came about later in the movie, which were just done casually.
Yeah.
Just as they were in real life, but never or rarely reported in the media, any kind of media, until a movie like that.
Right. Now, one of the things that you mentioned, Jim, and I'd like to ask Al about this, is the patent 90-degree turn. Mm-hmm. If that hadn't happened, would the Germans been able to go further than they did?
Probably not, because they were running out of gas, and they might have made it, was it to Dinant, where there was a fuel depot, but then they would have, you know, had to refuel there, and their penetration was getting thinner and thinner. You know, the points, the penetration was getting thinner and thinner, since we were holding the shoulders very well, and that was the key element of St. Vith and the guys on the south side.
Right.
The business with Patton, more interestingly, though, is, I mean, Patton comes off as this loudmouth guy, you know, who's really brilliant leading the troops, and we forget that he was also an extraordinarily careful planner, and his guys would do incredible amounts of staff work. So he would frequently just tell them, by the way, in addition to this, think about doing this if we have to. So
right.
That even, you know, once he heard about a German... what appeared to be a German penetration, and he apparently was beginning to think something was happening even before it happened. He basically told him, hey, just in case, suppose we had to move some, you know, troops, you know, 90 degrees northwards, why don't you guys just, you know, do some doodling on paper, you know, so that his staff people were always planning something.
Uh-huh.
And that gave him a big advantage. I mean, compared to the other armies, frankly, most of the other armies didn't, just they had mediocre staffs.
Right.
And his other advantage was that his flank, the southern flank, was in open, more open terrain. The northern flank was basically in mountains, you know, hills and forests, much rougher terrain. That's what made St. Vith capable of holding back such a, you know, an SS Panzer army was coming, trying to get through it. They had terrain in their favor, a lot of rivers, a lot of ravines. You didn't have that as much in the south. So Patton knew if he could get moving, he could fall upon the Germans on a broader front and do a lot more damage, which was exactly what he did.
Yeah. Right.
Because the other things that happened, too, the 106th Division, for example, which gets partly surrounded along with some other elements, there was an interesting morale problem in the division. Earlier in the war, the Army, thinking, you know, not being sure how long the war was going to last, since they were expecting it to last maybe to 46 or 47, was taking, you know, promising, you know, bright young draftees and whatnot, and sending them to college. And then, of course, we were also, you know, getting a lot of bright young guys and sending them to flight school. Well, shortly after D-Day, we began to realize that we're desperately in need of casualties. Our daily casualties in the war doubled beginning on D-Day, you know, despite all the fighting that was going on in Italy and the Pacific and so on. D-Day doubled the casualties. So the Army basically closed down the college program, and it turned out that we didn't need as many pilots as we had, so we turned a lot of these pilots, pilot trainees, and sent them back in the infantry. So the 106th Division was full of these young kids who were, you know, like in effect demoted. You know, they were going to be officers, as was the 104th and a couple of others. And the commander of the 106th just didn't know how to turn his troops into, you know, brilliant guys. I mean, Terry Allen gets 104th, same manpower, and it's the best of the late war created divisions, you know, because he knows how to turn guys into soldiers, despite the fact that they've been, you know, in effect demoted by the Army. So the 106th, a couple of regiments of that with some other troops gets surrounded. Then to top it off, the commanding officer's son, I think he's either killed or wounded, I forget, or taken prisoner, one of them. I think he's either taken prisoner or killed, I forget which. And he sort of just loses it. So he's not a very good commander to begin with. And then he loses it. Of course, the thing to do when you're surrounded is to hold out for a while. I mean, this is something that the Russians figured out eventually. You know, those mass surrenders, hundreds of thousands of troops early in the war. Well, if those guys had hung out, you know, for a couple of days longer or a couple of weeks longer, it would have taken the Germans a long time to clean them out. And, you know, that would have allowed other things to happen elsewhere. Because very often when you're using mechanized forces, people cut off in the back they're not being invested by anybody, especially in World War II, where the Germans are still using horses for everything except the Panzer divisions.
Right.
So that was a major problem in making the situation worse. The fact that, in effect, the whole division, or a major chunk of a whole division, just surrendered.
Right.
Now, another interesting angle to the 106th Division, my father's older brother, called him Junior, when he was drafted, the guys from Rockland County, this is north of New York City, a couple dozen of them, they were going in. Most of them ended up in the 106th Division, but not my uncle. His entry was delayed 24 hours because his mother, my grandmother, got very sick. And so they gave him compassionate, you know, leave to go just because they thought she might die. She had some bacterial infection before antibiotics were widely available. So he was allowed to run back there for 24 hours, and then he reported. And, of course, the way it works in the Army, sure, the bunch of guys he was with, they went, ended up in the 26th. About half of them were wounded, you know, or killed, and most of the rest were captured and spent a very unpleasant time in the Stalag. My uncle, of course, 24 hours later, he shows up, oh, we need aircraft pilots, not pilots, mechanics. So he spent, he was there for D-Day, but he was in England repairing P-47s instead of, you know, getting shot to pieces in the Ardennes. So it goes to show you what little things can make a big difference.
Right. Now, one of the things, Jim, is that the Germans actually, during this offensive, used some new weapons and techniques that hadn't been used before. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, actually, the one thing that doesn't get talked about much was an old technique they used to even pull this off. Nobody expected the Battle of the Bulge, because the intelligence people were certain. They were positive. Again, we were reading the Enigma, their codes, their secret codes. And so everybody was absolutely certain that there could be no German offensive. That's why it was such a big surprise. And the reason it was because the Germans declared, without thinking that we were reading their secret codes they used for wireless transmissions, they said, no, all communications regarding this offensive are to be carried by courier. No wireless communications.
Right.
And so we, because we had a technological edge on the Germans with, the code breaking, there was never any information to, obtain through this means. All the information was being carried by couriers, usually by, on ground, by railroad and by bicycle and what have you, delivering orders and what have you. And that was a great embarrassment. Because there were signs there. The people were reporting from the front that there's something strange. They heard, for example, the noises. You can hear, for example, tanks, at least World War II tanks. They make distinctive clanking noises when they're moving. And troops were recording at night as they moved those units up. They said, hey, we're hearing lots of tanks. We're in front of a second-rate German infantry division. What the hell they got doing with tanks back there? And the intelligence people dismissed, oh, they must be hearing things, there must be something weird, something else going on out there. It's impossible.
Yeah.
So any they say something's impossible, check a little deeper.
Right. Well, and it was amazing how the Germans moved up all those units, basically under cover of darkness, and then they were all ready to go. It was
under cover of the hubris of Allied intelligence.
Right.
I mean, the most senior people knew about the code breaking. They couldn't tell anybody further down the line. So when this information percolated up to a certain level, they just said, "Nah, it's got to be something else." We would have had it. We would have cracked. We would have seen the secret messages about this by now.
Well, and this is a lesson we still haven't learned because we keep repeating it, which we start relying on technology so heavily. Like, for instance, the Ultra machines, they were relying upon them being able to decipher everything. Well, we in the United States, before 9/11, we relied on technology instead of getting human intelligence. I mean, it's something that we continue to do over in America, and maybe it's because we're such a technology-dependent society.
This is a large part of it. I was a technology, called terrorism expert for several TV stations in New York in the 1990s. I'll never forget that. And they asked me, there was a bombing in 93 of the World Trade Center, which did damage, killed a few people, but was not huge. And they kept asking me, could they do worse? And I says, yes. And I says, the only reason they won't is if the FBI gets the money, which they were, and they basically stay on top of it. I said, it's all about, getting human intelligence, which is what the FBI is all about. They don't own any space satellites. And, of course, as we learned after 9/11, the FBI and the CIA weren't necessarily communicating. The FISA, the intelligence bureaucracy and the intelligence, the wiretapping authority and what have you, had gotten all wrapped up in basically protecting people's rights rather than finding spies and saboteurs and terrorists, and that's going to happen again. It's already happening again.
Right.
When people talk about, hey, all this intelligence and torture and intelligence gathering and wiretapping, it's destroying our civil rights. And of course, if you ask the question, well, how, when, give me examples, you never get any.
Right.
Because basically the paranoia operates in two directions. You can be paranoid about the terrorists, but you can also be paranoid about trying to catch the terrorists. And after a while, you get so wrapped up in all various flavors of paranoia that you're not listening to anything and things go boom. So you're right. Yeah, it happened in the Battle of the Bulge. It happened 9/11. And I guarantee you it's going to happen again.
Right. Now, Al, the Germans used something at the beginning of the attack called artificial moonlight. I came across a reference to this. What was artificial moonlight?
Since it was cloudy, you can use these, the big searchlights, anti-aircraft searchlights.
Yes.
You can beam them on the moon on the clouds, and that gives you a glow. And you don't necessarily need a huge amount of light to move around at night once you're used to it. So that was a technique you could use, aiming the searchlights at the clouds, and in effect bouncing the light off the clouds onto the ground, so you get a little twilight out there.
Uh-huh.
So the advancing German troops weren't stumbling around in the darkness. They had just enough light to make their way through our thinly defended lines.
Right.
Yeah. And, of course, the weather helped them tremendously the first few days. Let's see, the attack is on the 16th, and the weather clears, was it Christmas Eve or Christmas Day? Christmas Day, I think.
Christmas Day, yeah.
Yeah. And, of course, that meant that, in fact, the Germans had 9 days of no Allied air.
Right.
Which was a big help for them.
Now, the Germans did on the first day launch a major air offensive, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It didn't have much effect.
It didn't have much effect.
And didn't it cripple them for the damage that they took, it crippled them. Basically, they weren't able to ever pull off another offensive attack again with their air power.
Yeah, the big problem was fuel.
Okay.
And they used too much of it on the opening operation.
Opening day. They also used the ME 262 that day in mass for the first time. Is that correct?
Yeah.
But they were also suffering from the cloud cover. You get too low under the clouds, you end up driving into the ground. So while they tried to use their air power, they found that a lot of it was really useless because either the aircraft couldn't find their targets. Or they simply, couldn't get through the cloud, to the ground, to even go looking for something. So it worked both ways. But it helped them more than it hurt them, because if the skies were clear, we would have clobbered them. And that's another reason why we felt the Germans may never try an offensive.
Right.
But the Germans were basically rolling the die, as it were.
Yeah.
In making the offensive and hoping that they got enough consecutive days of overcast. They knew it was possible because just look at the meteorological, the weather charts for that part of the world. Anybody who's spent winters in Europe knows that there are a lot of overcast days.
Right.
And the Germans were just hoping, and they lucked out. They got 9 days, and that paid a huge part in them being able to keep on going.
Right. Now, Al, what are some books that our listeners can go to read about the Battle of the Bulge that are the premier books to read on the subject?
Well, the air dimension, what's his name? Andy Parker? Andy Parker To Win the Winter Sky.
Okay.
Extraordinarily good book on the air operations. He's a Battle of the Bulge maven, and that's his thing. There's also something called Decision of St. Vith, which is an old book. I don't even know if it's still in print, but it's about, the 7th Armored Division, I think it is?
Well, actually, any book is still in print because Amazon.com has connections for all these huge book dealers, so your chances are you can probably still get it out there.
Right.
Yeah. But it really discusses what they call the fortified goose egg at St. Vith, and the fact that the troops, even though the Germans had them almost surrounded, these guys not only held out very well, held the Germans off, but then pulled out of the pocket. I mean, a little now, that's why they call it a fortified goose egg, because it's this little lump jutting into the German front, and they pulled out after it became clear that they'd done their bit. I think Carlo d'Este did a book recently on the Bulge, and John Eisenhower.
Right.
Yes, Dwight's son. I was going to mention. He's the one I was going to mention. Another one to mention. I forget the author, but the Army Official History, the Green Books.
Right. Yes, right. Those are good. Yeah.
That was one of the. This was back in the 60s that came out. I think Leuchtenbach. I forget the guy. Anyway, you can probably find it on Amazon. But that is by far one of the best accounts. It's very straightforward.
Yeah.
And it was one of the first accounts to really get a lot of the facts of the battle out there.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not by no means, it's not a hard read, but it's not a popular history. But it's not a difficult read. So anybody who's really a buff of the war, if you can get a hands-on a copy of that, it's well worth reading, because you got to keep in mind that was the first post-war complete history of the battle.
Right. Those official histories are great. I know I use them in school for us. in college as, you know, initial reference books for a lot of the papers I wrote. The other thing was you mentioned John Eisenhower's The Bitter Woods.
Yeah.
What about Dupuy's book, Hitler's Last Gamble?
Well, it's really very dated at this point.
Okay.
We've come up with a lot of new stuff. That's one of the reasons the official history is very good, because they're extremely careful on speculation and whatnot. You know, they just say this is what we knew at the, you know, this is what we know now.
Mm-hmm.
So that they've held up pretty well as new material comes out. But Trevor was also sort of enamored of his mathematical relationships, so you have to be a little careful about that.
Right. I understand the writing for that one's very dense, too.
Yeah.
What about John Tolan's book, The Battle of the Bulge?
Popular history.
It's okay. Popular history, and as I recall, Carlo d'Este revised it?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, Carlo d'Este is one of the best people in recent years working on, you know, the German army and the West, you know, and Northwestern Europe. So that's a really big help.
Something I think most buffs of the battle will find useful is you go to AmazonCon and the comments for each book. You know, if you just search Battle of the Bulge and work on it down, I mean, it's quite an interesting experience. I mean, there's literally thousands of books that have been written about the battle.
Yeah.
You know, I've lost track of the bibliography because you can basically devote your entire life to just keeping up with it. But I think you will find, because there are a lot of very knowledgeable, you know, amateurs out there who read a lot of these books and come to some very intelligent, you know, conclusions about, you know, who's on first and who knows what they're talking about. And I would certainly point out that those comments are something you should, you know, rely on. The ones who are just yahoos and trolls, you know, they're fairly obvious.
Right.
But I think you'll find some very thoughtful, you know, comments on which books are good and why.
Right. Now, another way to learn about the battle is through some of our listeners know about this, some of them don't, is wargaming.
Yes,
and Al and Jim, you both have been involved in designing several war games around the Battle of the Bulge. What did you guys learn when you were designing the games?
It was a perfect situation for a game.
Yeah, it is. And one of the interesting things about the game is when you go over the map as you try to design a game, you begin to realize in many ways this is the worst place the Germans could possibly attempt a mechanized offensive, because they're basically traveling on these little roads through this huge forest of in very rugged terrain, and small numbers of troops can hold you up minutes, hours, days before you can break through, because you got to dismount your infantry and go through the woods and climb over the hills, and if they're held too. So that after the initial bound, you can see why the Germans get held. It's just this torturous attempt to fight in the Ardennes. In 1940, they move through the Ardennes and then come out of the rugged terrain before they actually have to engage the French. And even that,
yeah, 1940 was interesting for the Germans, because one reason they were able to get through there was because the Allies thought it was militarily impossible for a large, mechanized force to get through there. And they only basically had two battalions of reconnaissance troops, Belgian reconnaissance troops, stationed in there. So it was basically the huge weak point. What the Germans did was they went and sat down, their staff officers sat down and looked at the road net, both the few paved roads, and there were a lot of logging roads, you know, unpaved roads and what have you. And they basically worked out, it's like making a Swiss watch, as it were, in exquisite detail, you know, how they could proceed moving a mechanized army through. And it required very rigid, you know, control. The MPs had to be drilled. It was like running a railroad on a very complicated schedule. But Germans being Germans, they pulled it off, much to the surprise of the Allies. They couldn't believe the Germans had done this. The Germans did similar things like that throughout the war. But as Al points out, in 1944, it's a totally different story because you have combat troops in the Ardennes. And since you only have, I sat down in 1970 when I did, I think it was my first Bulge game, and I sat down using the original Belgian survey maps, which they had at one of the local research libraries in New York City, and I did an overlay on that, and I worked out the exact number of through roads, and there were like four of them, I believe, through the entire, and this is an area, what, 100 kilometers, you know, something like that, you know, wide frontage. And there were lots of other little roads and what have you. But basically, if you can block those four axes, as it were, ways through, nobody's going anywhere if they want to drive a tank or a truck.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So the German genius backfired them when they thought they could do it against, you know, anybody who's shooting back.
Right.
Yeah, Bastogne has seven roads entering the town. So some of these four roads essentially are converging there.
Well, that's what I worked out. There's only four routes, parallel routes, going all the way through. And so that's why Bastogne was so important, because there could be more than four if everybody didn't concentrate on Bastogne. But because of the nature of the terrain, you had, it wasn't so much there were raging rivers, but there were these damn ravines. You know, you come up, and all of a sudden there's a 20-foot drop, and there's no bridge. It's just nasty terrain. The roads, you know, are basically the ones that follow the path of least resistance. And the terrain is so rugged that even with engineers, you know, there's often, you know, you're not going to, you know, throw a bridge across all these gullies and other places in quickly enough in order to get your troops through before the enemy can reinforce themselves. So it was a major miscalculation on the part of the Germans. They basically thought they could brush the Americans aside. That's what they were saying. Yeah. Hitler always had a low opinion of the American troops, and basically it bit them in the butt in the Battle of the Bulge.
Right.
Well, I mean, Hitler only knew about America from, Call My Cowboy novels and gangster movies. So.
Well, that's another thing to remember. Don't believe your own press releases.
Right.
Yes.
Now,
I gotta go, by the way.
One of the things about the games is it's a great way to teach your kids about the history and like that. And I'm going to talk about some of the games that we have available on the site. But before I do that and before I let both of you go, I'd like to bring out the last dirty secret about the Battle of the Bulge, which is what is actually the official name for the Germans and what is actually the official name for the Americans of the Battle of the Bulge, because the Battle of the Bulge is just the popular name.
Well, the code word for the Germans was Bach am Rhein.
Which meant?
Yeah.
Watch on the Rhine.
Right. Which made it sound like it was defensive, right? This goes back to...
Yeah, yeah. They were defending the Rhine, which is what we thought they were doing. And the American official, the Ardennes
offensive. The Battle of the Ardennes.
Right.
Yeah, the Battle of the Ardennes.
Yeah. Well, thank you, gentlemen, and we'll talk to you next time. And I'm going to talk to our listeners a little bit about the games that they can buy on the site that with the Battle of the Bulge.
Excellent.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Bye. You can learn about the Battle of the Bulge reading some of the books that we mentioned. Also, another good way, like we talked about, is looking at some of the war games that are out there. Now, we have a war game store at strategypage.com. The roots of all of us go back to wargaming here at Strategy Page. We view it, though, as not an entertainment, although, you know, wargaming can be seen as entertainment, but really another way to study history and to learn about history or even about modern-day speculative events. Battle of the Bulge games have been around for a long time. Avalon Hill, one of the well-known board game companies for wargaming, did one of the first Battle of the Bulge games back in 1965. After that, dozens, if not literally hundreds, of Battle of the Bulge games have been designed by wargamers and others, both computer games and board games. In our store, we have several that you can go take a look at. One of the things that I believe that people learn when they
they play these games is, one, you'll get a feel for the actual geography, the layout of the land, the road structure like Jim talked about, the actual villages and like that, depending upon the scale of the game. Right now we have a couple of computer games that you can go in and buy. One is from HPS Simulations. It's called Bulge 44, and you can play the entire Battle of the Bulge starting in December and ending in January. It's played at a battalion level. It's a good one to take a look at. It'll take several hours to play the whole game, but it does have scenarios too, where you can just play what happens around Bastogne or St. Vit or any of the other areas in the game. They have a multitude of scenarios. One of the interesting things, too, is this game comes with an editor where you can set things up differently yourself to actually study how the battle might have occurred in a different way. Another computer game that we have in our store is called Close Combat, Wacht am Rhein, which is the German phrase for the battle. This is at a tactical level. It has several different scenarios. You're at a basically a squad level to a platoon level on this game. And so you're going to play at a very focused level in the game. So that's another one that you can take a look at. We also have several different board games done by several different companies. One of them is a game put out by GMT called FAB The Bulge. The FAB stands for Fast Attack Battle. And it's a simpler game. It uses something that we call area movement. A lot of war games use hexes. But this war game actually uses an area movement, and it also uses blocks, which gives you a fog of war feeling to the game. It plays very fast. It's sort of a different design than you'll find out there in other games. Another one that we have that you can take a look at is the latest version of Battle of the Bulge done by Avalon Hill, and it is Axis and Allies Battle of the Bulge. It's done by the same designer that did Axis and Allies. Now, the thing that's unique about this is it focuses very much on the front lines and where the front lines were in the battle. It has a unique rule system for that. So that's, you know, something that you can take a look at. We also have some tactical level games for the Battle of the Bulge. A company by the name of Avalanche Press does a series called Panzer Grenadier, and they have two different versions of scenarios that focus in on the Battle of the Bulge. Again, this is tactical. It's at the platoon level, focuses really on the armor aspects of the battle. And that's one of the things that you'll find in war games. If you go and do a search on Battle of the Bulge, or another great place to go if you want to take a look at board games on Battle of the Bulge or any era that you're interested or battle, is a website called www.boardgamegeek.com. And, you know, if you search on Battle of the Bulge or the Ardennes or Bastogne or Wacht am Rhein, you'll find a plethora of board games that are out there. Some of them are not in print anymore. A lot of them are. And you can take a look at those. So you can visit our war game store that you can find on the site, or you can go to some of these others. It's a great way to learn about history, and it sort of makes it more real than reading a book. It gives you a feel that you're not going to get otherwise. It's something that I look at from an educational point of view, and so do Al and Jim and Austin, that these games can actually teach you things that you wouldn't learn in a book necessarily. You get a really good feel of the battlefield and how the battle flows and like that, depending on how well the game is designed. So it's something that I'd take a look at. We'll talk to you next week, and everybody have a great week. Thank you. Bye.